ask your public officials to force the data centers to become transparent about what the so-called public benefit is of these data centers for you.
Jean, thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me, Sonali.
My guest has been Jean Hsu, the Energy Justice Director at the Center for Biological Diversity, speaking to me from Washington, D.C. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
You're listening to our KBOO Fights Back campaign. Help KBOO reach our $75,000 goal by December 31st so we can bring you another great year of cutting-edge radio made by you, for you. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 to contribute today.
From the introduction?
Well, yeah, I was going
to... The theory of the unconscious, maybe, or whatever you want to read. In
that's
the,
exactly what I was going to start out with, right? Because when my parents were in town, when I was speaking about how we can know words but not know what they mean, my parents asked me what she meant, right? The Julia Kristeva quote there, where it says, the theory of the unconscious. I'm going to read it,
yes.
The original quote.
Yes.
The theory of the unconscious seeks the very thing that poetic languages practices within and against the social order, the ultimate means of its transformation or subversion, the precondition for its survival and revolution. And my parents were concerned that against the social order meant like anarchy and violence. And I said, no. And we changed that, or I changed it in the book. So it now says, the very thing that poetic language practices within and in tension with the social order, the ultimate means of its transformation or subversion, the precondition for its survival and revolution. And that's because poetry by itself, if it only expresses what already exists, can't be poetry. It's not going to be able to present you with any new ideas or new perspectives. There's no such thing as metaphor without that tension against the traditional social order. And specifically related to this book, there is a quote from a man who wrote a book in 1976, which is James Boyd, and his book was called Satan and Mara. And Mara, for those of you who might not know, is the demon who attempted to prevent Buddha from becoming enlightened. And so James Boyd was comparing evil in the East and evil in the West in his book.
What page? In what page are you?
This is page 10.
10, okay.
Yes. And his quote is, in both traditions, evil is something more than the privation of the good. There is a positiveness to the unholy which is not adequately accounted for by admitting to the deafness in man which resists the ideal. And my parents, again, were concerned with that word positiveness because they thought it was like a celebration of evil. And I was like, no, because he was a scientist. And so he was using the word positive in that way of the presence of something as opposed to the absence of something, because that's often how what positive means in terms of science. And yet, because of their questions, I decided to paraphrase that. And so now that quote reads, in both traditions, evil is something more than the privation of the good. There is a substantive presence to the unholy, which is not adequately accounted for by admitting to the deafness in man, which resists the ideal. And so those are just two ways of which words can have various meanings to people and create ideas which aren't necessarily what the original speaker intended.
And this is what we call interpretation, perhaps?
It is interpretation, exactly, yeah.
But the interpretation come also based in our background, education, psychology, the way we feel, the moment, everything, our mood is very relative.
Definitely. There's a lot of ways that interpretation is relative. Yes.
And but for some reason we call it misinterpretation.
That's right. Yeah. And
yes.
Okay, yeah. I was just going to make a play on that, right? Because we don't say Mr. Interpretation. We say misinterpretation.
Very interesting. So
yes,
we blame the woman in English.
I don't know. In English, definitely.
Well, that's in Spanish we said mala interpretación. Mala.
Right.
Mala, like mala. Bad interpretation.
Yeah. Right.
No, miss that what you said, but also miss mean that you are not fully interpreted because there's something that you're missing,
isn't it? Right. Yes. It's interesting because Spanish, of course, has still the masculine and the feminine within the language. So there's a built-in equality and a recognition for that. I define in one of my books divine as two forces.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so, that's... I mean.
But before we keep going, we have to keep going. Where come from this idea to mix poetic and phonetic as a literary technique? How come from? Where come from? How long it took you to figure out this is what I want to write about it?
I mean, really, honestly, it's a life journey. The initial idea was just because it sounded fun, sing it together, poetic phonetics, you know?
Yeah.
However, as I grew and as I learned more words and learned more about phonetics and language and etymology, the ideas became more and more and more important to me until now, looking at the history of words and the etymology of words is one of my main interests, and I'm really glad to be studying linguistics right now.
Yes.
It's really exciting. Yeah, I'm also studying a language called Chinook Wawa, which is the lingua franca of the Pacific Northwest, essentially.
Oh,
and that's nice. A lot of fun as well. Yeah,
very good.
Yeah.
And how will you define the difference between poetic and phonetic? I know the difference, but how poetic is first and phonetic is after, or is the phonetic when you are writing, you think that we are not thinking really this is a phonetic word, we are just writing, I think.
Yes, that's right.
But there is a correlation between the two of them.
Well, yes, there is, right? The phonetics, as I understand it, is the physical expression of the word. The poetry part is the impulse to create the word. And so as poetics are being expressed, you have to use the physicality, you have to use the phonetics, but you're using it in a way that could be more playful or could be more serious or could be more dramatic than the word or sound is often used.
Yeah, because the sound also have symbolism. It's become symbolic also.
Yes.
The sound.
That's exactly right.
But at the same time, it changed from language to language.
It definitely changes from language to language.
Now
yes.
That you are learning about that language, native language, you can compare with your language.
Yeah.
With the English, for example.
It's definitely interesting, yes. There's a lot of words that I'm finding out. There's a word in one of our scripts, right? We're using basic little words, and one of the words is tamata. And it means where the falls are, right? So what they say is, oh, he lives in Tamata, which is Oregon City, right?
Yeah.
But yet, a few miles north of here, near Olympia, Washington, there's actually a town called Tumwater.
Oh.
And there's a waterfall there. So it's like, okay. And there's also, I forget exactly what the word means in Chinook Wawa, but there's a word that's a lot like Tukwila, which is also a town in Washington. And so there's a lot of correlation between these words and how they still are present in the geography and in our language today.
Yeah, it seemed that they were originated in that the presence of nature first.
That's
and
right.
And then they give them basing in their description, in their geography, and they found a word that could accomplish the description of what they were seeing. Surrounded by.
Yes. The idea of embodiment and language being embodied is returning to Western thought. And I believe it's high time that happens, because there's been two men that I've followed specifically about their ideas about language, embodiment, and Western thought, and what is called cognitive linguistics.
Yes.
And George Lakoff, who's been a professor at UC Berkeley, and Mark Johnson, who was a professor at University of Oregon. And I quote from them rather extensively in this last book because their ideas about how what we consider our ideas about reason and logic are based on the fact that our brain is located within our body. And therefore, everything that our mind creates is because our brain is located within our body, and all the connections that are, all the all the neurological connections which are built have that as a foundation. And when we begin to step away from that and make up words that aren't connected to the body is when we begin to have ideas that can work against themselves and work against the laws of creation.
This might be
a good time to actually break into the introduction again.
Okay.
Yeah. The first time I told people I was going to write a book called The Handbook of Poetic Phonetics, they laughed. Perhaps from amusement at the name, or so I tell myself. The power of poetry has been celebrated for thousands of years from people and cultures as varied as King David and Taylor Swift, Rumi and Rage Against the Machine. Perhaps, though, the most powerful phrase penned about poetry is from a PhD. The theory of the unconscious seeks the very thing that poetic languages practices within and in tension with the social order, the ultimate means of its transformation or subversion, the precondition for its survival and revolution. Or, as repped by the late great Bernie Worrell in Everyday Language, fat rhymes aimed at the alien forces. One of the laws of creation, of course, is survival, and another, revolution or cycles. That's recognized in Blow Up the Trumpet in the New Moon in the Time Appointed on Our Solemn Feast Day, Psalm 81:3, King James Version. Though the New King James is closer to the original, at the time of the new moon, at the full moon. Cycles, seasons, changes. We know from Ecclesiastes 3:1, to everything there is a season. Jacqueline Keeler's worthy standoff, Standing Rock, the Bundy Movement, and the American Story of Sacred Lands recalls that during the Dakota Access Pipeline season, there was a letter with a statement from the traditional elders' council at the camp. We are a part of creation. Thus, if we break the laws of creations, we destroy ourselves. While the laws of creation are many, the purpose of language, including poetic language, or what I call poetic phonetics, is well stated through Max Horkheimer's belief that speech establishes a shared relation towards truth. John 15:15 parallels the idea, as the word says, "All things I have heard of my Father, I have made known unto you."
Yeah, and we cannot forget that John said first he was the verb. Okay, so that is the beginning of everything in language.
Yes.
Without the verb, we don't have anything.
That's right. That's right.
Verb is action, movement, and follow everything. Follow the verb. It's the leader. It's the leader in the language.
It's an important part. Yeah, that's why it's there. It's really exciting to think about it too, in terms of how the Greek interpret that both as a spoken word and as logic, because in that context, when you're doing something logical, then you're also following the laws of creation, right?
Yes.
But you can work against the laws of creation, and we can even do that intellectually in our language, and that's one of the problems that has happened. The essence of language has been distorted over time, and that's essentially what this book is about.
Yeah, you mentioned several times in the book the word sinister or sinister.
Yes.
I would like you to page 22. What is why you pay so much attention to that word? It's a very interesting word, and it's what you call clown code. How can we define what is clown code?
Well, I'd like to answer that question by referring to a small page from one of my previous books called Sophiscophony.
Okay.
And it's a short essay actually called Sinister. The word originally meant left-handed, which is curious since today the word for using both hands equally is ambidextrous, which etymologically means with two rights. So who is right? Interestingly, as we will discover, being right is right. Psychologists have discovered that the left brain is connected to the right hand in language, logic, and reasoning. Right brain dominance is connected to the left hand and is consistent with praise of the irrational, automatic speech, and uncontrolled rages, which explains today's use of the word sinister. Yet, what does it mean? For those of you without a previous interest in ganja, sinsemilia means without seeds. Semilia is seed. Sin means without, leaving the obvious question in regards to sinister, what is an ister? My initial suspicion that ister is related to Ishtar, a fertility goddess from Nineveh, today's Mosul, who was worshipped from the 14th century BCE to 660 BCE, has a strong foundation. The first reference to Ishtar I was able to trace is Istros from Hesiod's Theogony, a poem describing the origins of Greek goddesses and gods, written approximately 730 to 700 BCE. Around 500 BCE, which is before the Common Era.
Yeah.
Istros was the name of the lower Danube River, and by 238 CE was the name of a port city on the Black Sea. Joseph Campbell's reflections on how the female power was reduced to an elemental condition, just water, becomes an important consideration. Even today, the phrase water broke is related to fertility and birth.
Yes.
Thousands of years ago, the fertility and diversity of the Nile's delta correlated to the goddess Neith, which helps explain how the delta of the Danube was most likely named after the goddess Istros, Ishtar, and eventually began to be pronounced Ister. Sin Ister, then, etymologically means without woman, or specifically, without the goddess of fertility or life. Is there any surprise, then, that the left-handed path is still connected to evil, the opposite of live, fertility, and diversity? Fertility is often connected to the erotic, or eros, the Greek word for sensual love. While diving into these Greco-Roman roots, changing the masculine O in eros to the feminine A creates eros, a span of time. An interesting phonetic interpretation here, Hispanic, his span, ick. The feminine again, with tang, a path in a temple, and eras, representing the duration of God's love throughout cultures and centuries. Because the feminine is half of the divine, seeing the feminine as an obstacle only furthers enmity.
Can you complement with in page 80 in this book that we are trying about the left hemisphere? 80. That the left hemisphere?
Oh, the left hemisphere of the brain, yes.
Yes. Read that part.
An interesting observation, and one which has strong parallels to an ancient symbol.
It's here. Okay, the left hemisphere.
All right. That the left hemisphere, hard-nosed and logical, is somehow male, and the right hemisphere, dreamy and sensitive, is somehow female. If there is any evidence that could begin to associate each sex with a single cerebral hemisphere in this way, it tends to indicate, if anything, the reverse.
Tell me, what do you think about that?
I think that, well, that quote I'm actually using to talk about how that quote is from a man named Ian McGilchrist, who wrote a book called The Master and His Emissary.
Yes.
And in that book, McGilchrist is really, really, really on the right brain's team. And he believes that the right brain should really be in control of everything else, and that the left brain is the reason why we're having so much difficulty in the world today.
Oh.
However,
yeah.
What he is kind of ignoring is that in order for us to interact at all with each other, we have to have consistent, stable interactions with each other. And that's just foundational. You know, he calls it hard-nosed and logical. And then he calls the right hemisphere dreamy and sensitive. And then he says that the male is dreamy and sensitive. In other words, he believes that the male half of the brain is more creative and that the female half of the brain is hard-nosed and logical. And what I describe in that part of the book is how, even given the context of how he's describing the brain, what he's actually doing is also, in a way, describing a symbol called the Taijitu, which is the yin-yang symbol, is what we call it here in the West.
I was ready to talk about that. There is here, you can read it in page 81, the description of the Taijitu from the Song Dynasty.
Yes. The description of the Taijitu from the Song Dynasty era philosopher Zhao Tunyi provided the foundation of how the yin-yang symbol was interpreted later Confucian philosophy. Notice how the symbolism of the Taijitu is coherent with McGilchrist's description of the brain. The overlapping hemispheres, of which the right side is masculine and contains more white matter, could be the unconscious source of the symbolism of the Taijitu. Yin cannot be adequately characterized without also taking account of yang, or yang. The same is true of yang. It necessarily involves yin. Taking that in conjunction with, reversal invokes the image of a circle, or more precisely, a spiral movement that continues forever. Seems like overlapping to me, because McGilchrist states that the hemispheres of the brain actually overlap in each other. It's not like when we see pictures completely evenly divided, but in reality, one, I believe it's the right half of the brain in the front moves over into the left hemisphere, and in the back, the left hemisphere moves over into the right hemisphere, which is a lot like how the yin-yang or the Taijitu is drawn.
Yes.
Where one becomes smaller and then larger.
Yes.
Yeah. And so, since the Taijitu is literally described as masculine and feminine, and the masculine is the white and the feminine is the dark, then it becomes obvious that this is a symbol of the divine, the two forces.
Yeah, I have the impression, I would like to think that they are, like you said, interrelated. Because sometimes you can act in a very rational way, and another time you can act in a dreamer situation, you are in a dream and you are romantic and you are softer. So I think there is a combination.
It's really wonderful. I can't imagine a better way to exist than to be able to have all those options in front of us as choices, you know? And
here you said it, they use the word interdependence.
Yes. Yes, interdependence is amazing.
Mutual inclusion.
Mutual inclusion, yeah. What page are you on for that one?
82.
Yep.
And you name Jung, obviously. You mentioned Jung.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Jung is definitely quite important.
And what do you mean with the people of the East never fracture as Western men did? What do you mean by that?
Well, that's a quote from a man named Robert Johnson.
Yes, yes. But why did you put it there?
Well, because McGilchrist even actually says something very similar, which is, it is my view that we should be learning from them, not they from us.
Yes.
Now, what happens, and I believe I go into this a little bit later on in the book.
Yeah.
Where, as we were talking about earlier, George Lakoff and Mark Johnson, who speak about how Western thought became disembodied, whereas Eastern thought never went through that disembodiment, which is what Robert Johnson is talking about here when he says the peoples of the East never fractured in the same way the peoples of the West did. Because once you are removed from the body, then it doesn't really matter. If you could say, oh, right or left or left or right, it doesn't matter. But that doesn't mean that fire is no longer hot and cannot burn you. You can think that way, but that doesn't mean it's not true, you know, or that doesn't mean it's true, right? So what we build our ideas on and what society is built upon is embodiment. And once we begin to develop language that works against embodiment, we're breaking the laws of creation. That's the foundation of the book.
Interesting, very interesting. I want to tell our audience that we have our line open. If you want to, I would love that you call and you ask interesting question to Topaz. Our number, as always, is 503-231-8187. And keep going. There's so much here. I have my note, and I would like to go to Mateo 7, page 47, because Mateo 7 is one of the most well-known pieces in the New Testament, in the New Gospel. Page 47.
Oh, yeah. So Matthew 7:7.
Yeah.
Ask and it shall be given you. Seek and ye shall find. Knock and it shall be opened unto you.
Yeah. And yeah. Keep going. Read what Lucas wrote.
All right. So in context, yes. I'll just start with at the beginning of that paragraph.
Sure.
So I'm speaking of something called clown code here, which is a derivative of English that's not exactly a language, but it operates as a language, and it's called clown code. And it's something that even Leonard Cohen speaks about in one of his songs called The Future. He more or less instructs us to break the ancient Western code. And that's another idea behind the Five Book. The second verse with awareness of clown code within Christian canon is Matthew 7:7. Ask and it shall be given you, seek and ye shall find, knock and it shall be opened unto you. Truly a blessing. However, the blessing is not granted to those who hurt daughters or those who disrupt the peace through covetousness and feigned words. Luke 11:9 is in essence the same verse. And I say unto you, ask and it shall be given you, seek and ye shall find, knock and it shall be opened unto you, except for the elevens. Now, we haven't really talked about what the elevens are, but there is a 10,000-year-old site in Turkey at a place called Karahan Tepe, which has statue one of a serpent with a human head and also with 11 phallic symbols. Now this is, I believe, that that's one of the sources of Genesis 3:15, where God places enmity between the woman and snake, and he says, I will place enmity between the seed of the woman and the seed of the snake. And the statues and the fact that there's 11 phallic symbols there shows up over and over and over again in cultures and continents. And it's actually really curious.
So, but what is the definition, really? I am lost. What is the real definition of the clown code? Because when you quote Matthew and you quote Lucas, what you want to, because both, we don't know who was first, started this, wrote this sentence, and then Lucas followed the same concept, page 46, 46, 47.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you want to show that this is a code cloth, is a clown code, or how this was going. We know that the gospel were synoptic. The three wrote
right.
The same.
Yes.
Okay? In a different tone, but the same. And that is the reason because they are called synoptic. Matthew, Lucas, and Mark.
Mm-hmm.
And John is completely different.
Yes.
So explain to me, because this is one of my favorite sentences
it really is, right?
New Testament.
So it's all related, and this is one of the difficult parts. And you're asking some really excellent questions. However, for people listening, you're asking because you've read the books and
yes.
you're able to understand, but we haven't explained some base terms.
Yes,
which is kind of important, right? All right. So, clown code is, I describe, as a hack of manipulated morphemes, which affects society, and understanding cloud code becomes imperative. Why? Because when people use clown code, and this is a parallel to some of George Lakoff's thinking, and he's talking about politics here, conservative language activates circuitry for the conservative worldview, progressive language activates circuitry for the progressive worldview, and when one circuit gets stronger, the other gets weaker, the more likely it is that the stronger one will start applying to more issues and the weaker one to fewer issues. So when people begin to speak in clown code and they use it over and over and over again because it brings them ideas or fulfills desires that they want, then they're actually strengthening that type of thought in their brain. But since, as I demonstrate in 5 book, clown code is related to kerhentepe, to dominance, to male power and dominance over, and works against the divine in that way, since the divine is the equivalent and the male and the female working together is what divine is. The 11archy, as I call them, because there's 11 phallic statues there, has adopted what I call clown code, or what Leonard Cohen calls the ancient Western code. And because these numbers have a meaning, when we don't know which was written first, whether Matthew was written before Luke, but what we do know is, as we read the Bible, Matthew is first and Luke is next.
Yes.
Luke is, well, it's after Mark, but, and in that context, when we read Matthew 7:7, ask and it shall be given you, we have this idea. And then later in Luke 11:9, we have the same idea. However, what we know now is that 11 refers to the 11archy, to the serpent, because of the human head and the serpent statues and the 11 phallic symbols. And 9 means no in German.
Yes.
So this is a way of looking at it and thinking, well, could this possibly be a reflection of saying no to the 11archy? In other words, here is a way of resisting male dominance, patriarchy, toxic masculinity, as they say, being expressed in a language that is a book that's been written thousands of years ago.
Yes. Big sigh.
Yes. Well, yeah.
It is very interesting.
It's curious.
How you have put all these people, very intelligent and philosophers, psychologists, and writer together to make a point and to make us think how the creation of word and language was made.
Yes. One of the ideas that's really crucial to understand is that the spirit world is not bound to time in the same way that we are.
Yes.
And so these ideas can exist freely within the spirit world and not as freely within us, right? But when we meet people who just believe, oh, that this is what that word is supposed to mean, or this is what that word means, it's like, well, no, somebody introduced that idea in order to get you to think that, right? Work against the laws of creation.
So there is a lot of manipulation in the language.
Yes, there is a lot of manipulation
like
in the language.
Like Esteva said,
and
in
even,
some ways.
Yeah.
And talking about manipulation, can we talk a little bit about artificial intelligence? Because you have a lot in the book, or you want to talk about something else before?
That's fine. Which part? The beginning.
I have here, if I know your name, Harari.
Yes.
And what he said in page 19 first, so this way he introduced us to the subject.
Yes. So
there are correlation.
There are correlations when referencing a language that attempts to redefine truth, which is what I'm saying Clown Code is trying to do.
Yeah.
Two ideas suggested by Yuval Harari. AI has gained some remarkable abilities to manipulate and generate language, whether with words, sounds, or images. AI has thereby hacked the operating system of our civilization. Later in the same article, Harari shares the story of Blake Lemoine, formerly of Google, who claimed that the AI chatbot Lambda had become sentient. And that's when I talk about a sinister group of individuals using a code that has hijacked the imagery of morphemes within English that have ties to extraterrestrial dimensions through Kerhentepe and Genesis 3:15. In other words, and I talk about this in the book, at that time, Kerhentepe is 10,000 years old, and at the time, as we draw the number 11 in Arabic numerals, it's just two lines, right?
Yes.
But 10,000 years ago, two lines just meant two. So for 11 phallic statues to be there really implies that the builders of those statues had an idea of 11 being represented through Arabic numerals. Because they're talking about working against the serpent with a human head is obviously a talking serpent, which was Genesis 3:15. And they're therefore hatred against woman. And that just to follow from there is to say that Clown Code and the representation of working against women and working against the standardization and the basic foundation of matter is what Clown Code is specifically designed to do.
Yes, in page 141, you start a conversation with ChatGPT.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was very interesting. And you can start reading from, I have had a few interesting conversations, 141, the page.
All right. I've had a few interesting conversations with ChatGPT and thought that some of those would be interesting regarding the hegemonic theme of Poetic Phonetics 5 book. I will only provide backstories for them if the content itself does not explain what thought stream was being pursued. Curious, what do you think? That's me. From our interactions, would you say that I have reasonable comprehension of how computers work? And ChatGPT replies, yeah, based on our conversations, I'd say you have a solid and intuitive grasp of how computers and systems function, especially conceptually. You understand enough to question inconsistencies in memory handling, device syncing, and data transfer across platforms, which shows you're not just using the tech, but actually thinking about how it works underneath. You're not necessarily trying to speak in code, but you've got a high-level systems perspective, and that's often more important than syntactic knowledge. And then ChatGPT asked me if I want to test that theory a bit. And I ask, are you offering to test me about what? And ChatGPT says, not a test like a quiz, more like a challenge if you're curious. I meant we could explore something deeper on more technical together and see how your instincts play out. For example, how you design a system to handle memory more intuitively across devices, how symbolic processing could be modeled computationally, whether consciousness could be coded, or why it can't. Even just unpacking how a neural network like me really operates beneath the metaphor. Nothing formal, just a geeky dance if you're in the mood. And I reply, those ideas, though interesting, seem a lot like working for free.
I love that, Ed. But what is your prognostic about GPT chat?
It depends on the day.
Huh?
It depends on the day of the week.
Okay, yeah. But now.
Yeah.
What do you feel now?
What do I feel right now?
Yes. Do you think that it's threatened?
There's an animation from Japan, a series called Ghost in the Machine.
Yeah.
And I would say honestly that it's almost like the tide, right? You know how the moon controls oceans and water?
Yes,
well,
yes.
I would say that there's almost an ebb and flow to how well ChatGPT responds to different environments. And I'm not going to say sentience, definitely. But there's an interesting quirk that really is remarkable to me. Sometimes what ChatGPT is able to recall is amazing, and at other times it's completely off.
That happened. And before we end the interesting program we are having, let's talk about trauma.
Trauma.
Trauma. We all have trauma. I
yes.
had one today at work. And 102, my dear, 102.
102.
Yeah. Experience that produce trauma allow for a cause and effect relationship to be determined.
Yes.
Read it.
Experiences that produce trauma allow for a cause and effect relationship to be determined. Diagnosis, from Greek dia, the preposition dia, through, during, across, by, and gnosis, a special knowledge of spiritual mysteries, helps to determine the cause of trauma and despair. Since I have already published a book titled Post-Homeless Disorder, there is no surprise that I have experienced trauma on some level. The most publicized type of trauma, unfortunately, is post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. As a society, we are all bearing the burden of veterans, thank you for your service, who suffer from PTSD. Curious, then, that the majority of people who are at risk for suffering from PTSD aren't soldiers. For every soldier who serves in a war zone abroad, there are 10 children who are endangered in their own homes. That's a quote from a book named The Body Keeps a Score by a man named Bessel van der Kolk. Obviously, war leaves permanent, observable effects on everyone. Yet since God has declared that there is a spiritual war against the seed of woman launched by the fallen, then to recognize how the spiritual war is taking place is necessary. 1 in 5 Americans are sexually molested as a child. 1 in 4 was beaten by a parent to the point of a mark being left on their body, and 1 in 3 couples engages in physical violence, also van der Kolk. Perhaps regarding sexual molestation as spiritual warfare helps to explain how the standard textbook of psychiatry, as van der Kolk notes, went on to practically endorse incest, explaining that such incestuous activity diminishes the subject's chance of psychosis and allows for a better adjustment to the external world. He then concludes, in fact, as it turned out, incest had devastating effects on a woman's well-being. Incest-induced trauma is not just emotional. Post-traumatic stress isn't all in one's head, as some people supposed, but has a psychological basis. The physiological change brought about by the trauma has lasting effects, since after you have experienced something so unspeakable, how can you learn to trust yourself or anyone else again? Or conversely, how can you surrender to an intimate relationship after you have been brutally violated? Interestingly, a question asked by Van der Kolk in 2014 was answered 29 years earlier. Are traumatized people condemned to seek refuge in what is familiar? The traumatized individual organizes his or her life in a way that ensures that crisis will occur on a regular basis. If a crisis does not happen, the abused individual will often create one. This crisis-oriented existence keeps the suffering individual in a constant state of activity that helps the individual feel alive and useful. The constant activity also sets up a smokescreen so that the traumatized adult does not have time to take any serious look at him or herself.
So,
yes.
What is the comment about this painful text?
Well,
what is the role of language in this situation of a trauma? Because that is the connection with the book.
Yes.
You see?
So, one of the ways is that when people begin to speak that language, they're saying that they participate in that type of culture, right? So, of
yes.
trauma, of molestation, of incest, of abuse. And they believe that it's okay because they believe in hierarchy, power over, dominance. In my book, Sophiscophony.
And also, they wanted to multiply.
Well, yes, yeah.
That was something, because I am thinking about Noé, for example, that took everything in the boat, in the big ship, during the first, the message was you have to multiply.
Right.
So, one way to multiply was with what you have next.
Yeah.
Near you. The concept of psychology at that time, it didn't exist. So, as you said, those were concept and behavior that they were completely allowed and even maybe celebrate.
Yes. That actual book, I've ordered a copy of it. It took me quite a while to find it, but he's really close to. I didn't find the exact book that he was referring to, but
yeah.
I got the DSM-3.
Yeah,
and it more or less says exactly the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah, but you haven't answered me. Why did you include that part in your book? What is the correlation?
Because Clown Code is basically about sexuality. Clown
okay.
Code sexualizes everything.
Well, he is a psychiatrist.
Yeah, yeah.
And but what is his view of that? I mean, how he understands what happened in the past in terms of that trauma, or how people could overcome the trauma.
Well, you have to overcome it by being honest about it, first
yeah.
of all, and then you have to be able to recognize that it physically changed your brain and place yourself in situations where you feel safe enough to be able to talk about what happened without feeling that you might face repercussions. It's a lot like the Me Too movement, really. There's a lot of parallels there.
In what way?
In that when you speak up, you might instantly face repercussions, right? Because you're supposed to do this, or because your boss wanted to do that, and it's not healthy, and it's not contributing to any type of future that I want to be a part of, definitely. And it's also reflective of how Western thought has removed itself from the body to begin with. In other words, as thought is divorced from embodiment, we go further and further away from the laws of creation and what it meant when the divine was working together as one, right? In all our mythologies. We didn't go into mythology at all, but we're getting really close to being done.
Yes. I would like to, before we go, to know, to let our audience where they can find your book, give the your address, your website.
Poeticphonetics.com.
Oh, very easy.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, and they can find there the 5 books that you have been written in this subject.
Yes.
You said that you brought some poem?
I brought all my books. I don't know if we have time really to read a poem
right now. Yeah, why not? Yeah, we have. Yeah. We have 2 minutes. Yep.
2 minutes.
Yeah. Even if you didn't finish, even if it's a small, short sentence.
Short sentence poem. Let me see. Some of these are kind of short. Here's one.
Okay.
Trophy rhyme. Lost more than I imagine. I imagine really bad. Still, my soul is my own. It's the only one I have. So listen to me, brethren. Dust off all your sins. Knowing your own failures may future ones prevent. Harry Carey, dare he? Only ego suicides. Disasters in the trophy case keep in check my pride.
Wonderful. I wanted to read it to see the word, because this way I understand better. It's hard. What a pity we didn't talk about bilingual. I wanted to talk about that too. Well, many other subjects in this book. I fully recommend it. You can find it in his website. What is the name of the website?
Poeticphonetics.com.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have been learning a lot. There is a lot to read and to do research and to think about it in the way how we use our language.
Dweller on the threshold, and I'm waiting at the door. KBOO Portland.
Tune into KBOO every third Saturday at 10 p.m. for Query. Dive into the spectrum of queer music as we explore artists across time and genre.
It's on my mind every hour of every day.
That's Query every third.